it's very gratifying to think about all the progress that's been made since those early days of taking care of these tiny children who didn't know what was wrong, why they were there, why their parents were not with them.
That was John Laszlo, professor emeritus at Duke University Medical Center and former national vice president for research at the American Cancer Society. I'm Alex Carolyn, associate editor of the Cancer History Project. When Laszlo joined the acute leukemia service at NCI in 1956, the cure for childhood leukemia seemed beyond reach. Laszlo's book, The Cure of Childhood Leukemia, Into the Age of Miracles, is based on taped interviews with doctors and scientists. It is an authoritative primary source and is now available for free as a digital download on the Cancer History Project. His father, Daniel Laszlo, a physician who specialized in cardiovascular physiology, found a job in cancer research at Mount Sinai Hospital. He went on to study folate antagonists in mice, though folate antagonists hadn't been characterized yet. The untested regimen was administered against his recommendation to none other than Babe Ruth. The following recording is between Laszlo, who is 92, myself, and Paul Goldberg, editor and publisher of The Cancer Letter.
Thank you very much for agreeing to talk with us, Dr. Laszlo. And we were hoping you would kind of walk us through your early career and NCI, the years at NCI and childhood leukemia, and we'll take it from there, I guess. The first question would be how, I guess I should ask you how about your parents, their decision to come to America?
Well, I graduated from Columbia College, went to Harvard Medical School, and then took a rotating internship at the University of Chicago, because although I knew I wanted to go into internal medicine, I needed to know more about surgery and how patients did after surgery and the preoperative preparations. So for that reason, I took a rotating internship. After my internship, I went immediately to the National Cancer Institute for my next assignment, which was a two-year assignment in the Public Health Service at the National Cancer Institute. And after being on the emergency room at the University of Chicago for 2 days in a row, I drove from there to New York to see my family, and then immediately down to Washington, D.C., where I arrived a little bit rattled, not knowing my way around the city, not having a place to stay just yet. However, I had to start right away at the National Cancer Institute, and I was given my assignment, which is to work on the acute leukemia service. So here I am, having worked with adult patients in years prior, and not having worked with children in a setting like they had at the Cancer Institute. So it was a real challenge. And what was especially challenging was a ward full of children with acute leukemia who were bleeding at the time, who had high fevers, who had headaches, and were generally very uncomfortable. I was given some orientation by Dr. Freireich and Dr. Fry, and then left to my own devices on the Children's Leukemia Ward. It was a pretty challenging thing for a pretty green doctor who just finished a rotating internship. But I dove right in, and it was very challenging to deal with children who were bleeding from the nose, who were bleeding from the rectum, who were vomiting, and where parents were hovering about, very concerned about their children. And we did what we could by stopping the bleeding in the nose, packing the nose, giving antibiotics to children with high fevers, and so on, as best we could. But it was a time that these children were just not going to do well. You knew that walking in. You could help some of them, but most of them you couldn't help at that stage of the game. So as I look back on it so many years later and think about how 80+% maybe higher, maybe closer to 90% of these children live a long time after their treatment, presumably cured. It's very gratifying to think about all the progress that's been made since those early days of taking care of these tiny children who didn't know what was wrong, why they were there, why their parents were not with them. It was very challenging.
Well, I wonder if we could go back a little bit to, not a little bit, a lot, to your parents, because your father did the folate studies and worked with some of the treatments that were used in childhood.
That's right.
Yeah, so what, maybe we should just go back to, so you were born in 1931. I've read your book many times. So you were born in 1931. Where in Vienna?
Well, I was born in Cologne, because my father, although he studied in Vienna and trained in Vienna, he was on a postdoctoral fellowship in cardiovascular physiology in Cologne. So in 1931, I was dropped off there and lived there, I guess, for the first 2 years of my life before my parents moved back to Vienna. But I left Vienna in 1938, just in time with my parents, and came to the United States, where my father took a job in cancer research at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, where we lived for a period of time. And he had changed. He was asked to do cancer research, which he had not done before, but he was good in chemistry. And he worked with some wonderful chemists, I believe at Lederle, who were working on folate derivatives, although folic acid hadn't yet to be officially discovered at that time. But they were working on derivatives of that molecule and were finding some anti-cancer effects in mice. And I would go in on weekends, help to change the cages, put the mice in fresh cages, feed them, change the water bottles, and do that kind of thing as a child, and in the laboratories at Mount Sinai Hospital, which, by the way, the same laboratory area where my father originally worked with mice became Dr. James Holland's offices years later when he became director of cancer at Mount Sinai Hospital.
Oh, it's fascinating. But your family decided to leave Vienna because of Anschluss, because of what? Were they anti-Nazi? Were they Jewish? What's the reason?
No, as Jews, we were not welcome to stay.
I didn't realize you're Jewish, because Laszlo is a Hungarian name. So,
right.
Yes.
All Laszlos are Hungarian. Don't let them tell you any differently. yes, I was kicked out of school because I was Jewish, and it was a real struggle for my parents to get the necessary papers to emigrate to the United States. The U.S. State Department was very, very tough in those days, extremely exclusionary, and a lot of people who would have liked to have come were unable to do so. You had to have you had to have promise of a job in the United States in order to get papers to come. And then you had to have a backup family who would say, yes, we'll take care of Laszlo's or whoever in case they lose their job. You had to have, imagine trying to work from a foreign country, not knowing the language, to get a job, and yet to find another family who would vouch for you and take you in case of emergency. So all of that had to be done before we were able to come to the United States.
Oh, wow. So what was the passage like?
Well, the passage was interesting until everything was fine until we got to Manhattan, and then the storm moved in. The biggest hurricane ever to hit New York City prior to that time was on, I think it was September 28, I've forgotten the date, 1938. There's a famous hurricane that shut down the city, shut down everything in New York. We were not able to land at Ellis Island because the seas were so rough. We were taken in by tugboats and put into a slip in Manhattan, and I had to be carried off the gangplank by a sailor on either arm who carried me across. And at that time, I asked my parents, why would you come to a place like this with a storm like this? And of course, the next morning, when I awoke and went downstairs, beautiful sunny day, as though nothing had ever happened.
Wow. And where in New York did your family end up?
Well, we were living with this family that agreed to take us in. They were on Lower East Side, I believe, about 12th Street and 2nd Avenue. And we had a room or so in their apartment. And that's where we lived probably for 2 or 3 weeks until my father was able to locate other arrangements on East 97th Street.
And around that time is when he got involved in cancer research?
Well, my father immediately went into his job at Mount Sinai. I was only 7 years old at the time that we came to the United States.
Oh, wow.
So he was a clinician in Vienna, and then suddenly he's in the basement working with mice in a different profession.
Absolutely. Ooh. But he was incredibly clever and talented, and he made so many contributions to medicine. And having found this nutritional aspects of cancer and this particular kind of substance, which seemed to be a vitamin derivative that would inhibit the growth of cancer, was something that they were very surprised at. And they took the information to other experts at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, and they were very interested in it, but didn't quite believe it. So they asked Dr. Sidney Farber from Harvard to comment on it. He poo-pooed the whole idea and then took it over himself.
Nice.
Wow.
So were you expected to become a physician? How did that work?
Well, I didn't have any expectation to become a physician at that point. I was interested in agricultural science and thought maybe I'd make a career in that. But somewhere along the way, I guess I was already in college at Columbia, that I decided to go into pre-med and made a career of it.
Where did you go to medical school? Yale, I thought?
Harvard.
Harvard, okay. Whoa, wait, this would be very much of a quota situation then. So that must have been very interesting, the anti-Semitism and the quotas.
Well, it was helped by the fact that I also applied to Yale, and they sent me a telegram that said that that they would accept me, but I had to answer in 10 days that I wished to attend Yale. And so I contacted Harvard and said, I have And I'd like a rapid answer as to whether you'll take me or not. And they said, no, we can't do that. But then they called me back and said, well, we will take you. So the knowledge that Yale was pressing for an answer may have influenced Harvard. I don't know.
That's great. Yale too had famously had the same quotas, right?
I would presume so.
It was like 10 to 15%, and medical school was even more rigid. That's less, right? So that, wow, that must have been quite a time for you to do this.
As a student, you never know what's on the other side of that curtain that's called the admitting committee.
So I'm curious, when did you first find that you were drawn to oncology?
When I was an intern, I didn't know what I was going to do the year after I finished my internship. I didn't think I wanted to stay at the University of Chicago. And then a former classmate of mine had called me and said, you know, there's this thing called the National Institutes of Health and the National Institutes of Health. And that counts as time in the service because you're a member of the Public Health Service. And it's a 2-year position. And they have a number of institutes at the National Institutes of Health. He said, I'm going into tropical medicine. I want to study tropical medicine. How about you? And I said, well, I'd like to study internal medicine. I'm sort of interested in cardiology. So he said, well, go and apply. I contacted the Heart Institute and they were full for the next year. So what else? And there was a cancer institute and I decided to try that. The nice thing about working in the field of oncology, the word oncology hadn't been invented yet, by the way. My father had by this time moved to Montefiore Hospital and had started a service called neoplastic diseases, which was the first ward in a general hospital devoted to patients with cancer. Anyhow, I applied to the Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health and had an opportunity to speak with Dr. Zubrod. And he said there only was one position left for the following year that I could possibly apply for. And he knew that my father at this time was working on breast cancer and anti-hormone therapy. And he had met my father. So I guess he liked my credentials and decided to take a gamble on me. So I somehow in the middle of my internship, I ended up getting the last position at the National Cancer Institute for July 1.
Wow, can we go back a little bit? Your Chicago, yeah. Which of course did not play the quotas game at all, they didn't care. Charlie Huggins was there with—
Yes.
The hormones, that's the Nobel Prize for—
He had just gotten the Nobel Prize a year or two earlier and I had an opportunity to visit with him in his lab.
Ooh.
What an interesting fellow he was. You walk into his lab and said, look, Laszlo, there's a Nobel Prize here. he was not a modest man, shall we say.
Ooh.
But he was very accomplished, obviously. And I learned a bit from him. Although I was not in a laboratory, I was an intern seeing patients. But I was inspired by him and also a lot of good doctors who were interested in oncology. I can't remember them all. Jacobson was the head of the Cancer Institute. cancer program there. He had done a lot of work on radiation therapy. So
John Altman was there.
Yes, John Altman, I didn't know there. He might have been a year or so behind me. I can't recall.
Yeah.
But you're but right. He was
there maybe later. Yeah, because he was in New York for a while. So
yes.
Yeah. Wow. And so your father actually, can we go back to him again?
Sure.
He becomes a clinician again in the United States after the war, right? Sometime.
Yes. He had done some work on the folate antagonists, which he didn't know what folate antagonist exactly was because it hadn't been characterized just at that time. It would be in a year or so. At any rate, the work that they did on experimental cancer in mice led to an interesting event. A man was admitted to Mount Sinai Hospital with, I believe it was laryngeal cancer.
Babe Ruth,
thank you. It was Babe Ruth. So he was admitted to Mount Sinai Hospital in bad shape. He had been there before. And the hospital director wanted to do something for this famous patient. And they went to the laboratory director, who was my father's boss, and said, "What have you? I hear you've got some interesting chemicals that might be useful." So Dr. Lewison, who was the director of the laboratory, was a surgeon. He said, "Well, Laszlo has these drugs that are doing some things in animals." So the director called my father in and said, "I want you to give this medicine to Mr. Ruth." And my father said he couldn't do that because it had never been given to patients. They didn't know what the dose was, how much to give, how long to give it, and so on. And however, the hospital director wouldn't take no for an answer, even though my father thought it was unethical to do that. So he was ordered to give this to Babe Ruth, who had a brilliant remission. The tumor disappeared. And Ruth had come in miserable shape. He went home feeling just fine, and he stayed in remission for a time. At any rate, without divulging his name, he was the subject of a paper given to the Medical Journal of North America, I think is the name of it. And there was a meeting in Chicago of the society every year, and this paper was included there, never naming the patient himself. My father was very unhappy about being ordered to do something that he felt was unethical. And so he chose to leave Mount Sinai Hospital and was offered an opportunity, I don't know how this came about really, to start a new program at Montefiore Hospital in New York, where they had a lot of patients sitting around in taking up hospital beds, and they weren't doing much for these people. They've prostate cancer, advanced prostate cancer, but they had nothing to do with them, to do for them. So they were lounging there. So my father went to Montefiore Hospital and started this program for patients with advanced cancer and called the neoplastic division, neoplastic disease division. And he did something really quite remarkable there. He took many of these patients and sent them home because many of them were locals from the Bronx. They could go home and be taken care of at home. And he developed his residents to make house calls on them at least on a weekly basis. And he himself made house calls and I occasionally joined him. I occasionally joined my father in making visits to these brownstone houses, and we would walk up two or three or four flights of stairs to see a patient who'd previously occupied a hospital bed, but was now being taken care of at home, and administer what medicine they needed and so forth. So that started the, that's a whole other story, yeah. Paul, of the start of the home health program, forgotten what it was called, but Dr. Martin Czerkaski, who was hospital director, was very active in forming this new program based at Montefiore Hospital. So he then mobilized as a consequence of rearranging the bedding situation at the hospital for patients who were not getting active treatment but could be treated at home. He then was able to get patients in that they were actively treating, and he started intensive research on cancer, on calcium metabolism, started a program with radioactive iodine for thyroid cancer, quite a number of things that were started at Montefiore Hospital.
Wow. And what was the language that your family spoke at home?
Well, there were three of us, my father, my grandmother, and I. My mother had died shortly after coming to the United States. She discovered that she had breast cancer while we were on board the Ile-de-France, coming to the United States, and she succumbed about 2 years later. So there were three of us. My grandmother only spoke German, but my father really only wanted to speak English, and he spoke it quite well. My mother was the linguist in the family, and she was teaching my father how to speak English while we're on the ship coming to the United States. So she started him off.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, she was a psychiatrist who trained with Anna Freud.
So it's just an amazing family.
And she was studying for medical boards while we were on a ship to the United States, preparing to take medical examination, which she needed to have, which she passed. Of course, was never able to practice. But
when did she die?
I think 1940.
1940. Oh,
2 years after. 2 years after we arrived.
Do you remember what her treatment, if any, looked like at that time?
I don't think she received anything other than palliative care. I don't know. I was sort of pushed out. I was sent to a boarding school to study out of town. My father was busy with his job, with taking care of my mother, and with trying to get his parents out of Hungary. So he was very busy, and I would have been in the way. So they got me off to another school out of town, which did not work well for me. I was boarded with old friends of my father from Vienna. One was a well-known pathologist, and another was a neurosurgeon who really did some pioneering work in the autonomic nervous system. Anyway, they each took me for some months while my mother was dying.
Meanwhile, your father is playing with hormones, trying to figure out what role they play in cancer. Was it
breast
cancer?
Yes, that's right.
Was he trying to cure breast cancer?
He was doing studies on breast cancer. He did some of the early work on treatment of breast cancer with estrogens. BJ Kennedy and my father published some papers.
Wow. I knew BJ Kennedy too. So, wow. Thinking back, you know, a lot of kids were young doctors were being told not to go into oncology, but oncology was all around you, it looks like.
Yes, that's true.
It's like everywhere.
That's true. And so, when I was at the National Cancer Institute, I was confronted by these naysayers all very frequently. You're wasting your time, Laszlo.
At NIH or was it your Chicago? Did they tell you just go into cardiology like all the other smart people?
They were too busy doing their own things to bother about me. What I decided to do, they were supportive of whatever I wanted. They really were largely surgically oriented, and they wanted me to stay and go into surgery. But I was not interested in that specialty of medicine, except to learn about what they can do for patients and how to prepare patients for surgery and how to take care of them postoperatively. And for that, they were superb as far as I was concerned. But I wasn't interested in learning how to tie knots and do surgical procedures.
In the beginning of our call, you painted a pretty dismal picture of, you know, what childhood leukemia looked like at the time, just how painful it was. And why is it, do you think, that you wanted to go into that?
Well, I didn't particularly choose to go into that. I chose to go to the National Cancer Institute because I didn't get into the Heart Institute. And I was assigned to the Leukemia Ward. And a very interesting thing happened while I was on the leukemia ward. We had a lecture from a Dr. Dean Burke, B-U-R-K, who's a PhD at the National Cancer Institute, and a kind of a contrarian, so a superb scientist. He would go every summer to work with Warburg in Germany, and they worked on both cancer metabolism and photosynthesis, which was their two interests. And then he would come back for the rest of the year at the National Cancer Institute. He was a basic scientist. He came to give a lecture one time to our group at the NCI, I guess at the invitation of Dr. Zubrod. And he talked about all cancer cells have this unique feature of aerobic metabolism, which distinguishes them from normal cells, which don't do that kind of thing to raise their high energy phosphate ATP. So I asked Dr. Burke afterwards if I could meet with him, and I said, can we test this out on human cells, leukemic cells? He said, well, I don't know how to do that. I said, well, I can get the leukemic cells if you help me with the technological aspects. And he said, yes, if you'll do the work. He said, I'll help you. And so what I would do is, when I had patients that had high blood counts with leukemic cells, I would take a large sample down to building 6. Building 10. And I would go down the hill to his lab, and then we would separate out the white cells from the red cells and concentrate the cells away from some of the plasma. And then we would incubate those cells the way he would incubate mouse cancer cells in Warburg flasks on a shaking water bath. You have ever seen those. These would be little flasks, and they would be in a large vat of water. And then we would test how much oxygen the cells were consuming, how much CO2 they were producing, and we could calculate how much aerobic glycolysis they were consuming and how much anaerobic glycolysis they were making. So you can either make glucose in the presence of oxygen, which is aerobic, or in the absence of glucose, which is anaerobic glycolysis. And I began to get some things that were really quite interesting that seemed not, some of which followed the Warburg hypothesis, but some of which were contrary to Warburg's hypothesis. It turns out that myelocytes, they got lots of their ATP from anaerobic glycolysis, but lymphocytes did not. They breathed like normal cells. So I was able to compare the metabolism of normal leukocytes to leukemic leukocytes work that was partially done at the NCI and partly done after I finished at NCI and went on to Duke. But we then turned to studying how drugs influence cell metabolism. So I was able to, while I was taking care of patients, I was also working in the laboratory with Dr. Burke and as my rotations through the National Cancer Institute continued and I was assigned to different wards, I still maintained a contact with the leukemic service and was able to get samples for our work in the laboratory.
While you started all of this research, would you ever have conversations with your father about it? What was that like?
I would have conversations with him about it. He was very interested in it. In fact, he had done a little bit of work in Vienna with a Warburg apparatus and cancer cells. So he was very interested in what I was doing. But I was full-time down at the Cancer Institute. I didn't spend much time in New York to actually see him. And he was very busy in New York taking care of his new division.
Going back to your arrival to NCI, the year is what, 1950?
It would have been seven.
Seven. Events in Hungary had just taken place, so it's a pretty scary time too.
Yeah.
So your show off, this is actually a doctor's draft is still ongoing. So you're the first of the Yellow Berets, right? You would be considered that.
I didn't care for the terminology, but yes.
Well, people said it very proudly. They did like it, being calling themselves Yellow Berets.
I thought it was a most wonderful opportunity to get started in my life's career,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time meet my service obligations. It was just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
So you're wondering, so I think if I'm not wrong, Zubrod was first joined NCI in 1956 as well. So he was there for about a year trying to figure out how to spend some money.
Yeah.
Freireich had just kind of come in and Zubrod gave him an order to cure childhood leukemia.
That's right.
So what was your meeting with Zubrod like?
I really cared for the man. He's just a wonderful gentleman. A solid scientific background and clinical research, and knew what he wanted and what he expected of people to, how to conduct ethical research, taking care not to abuse patients in any way during the course of clinical studies on them. And he had Tom Fry came before Freireich,
mm-hmm.
and that is a very interesting story, which I know you know since you read the book, how they met. Freyreich thinks he's going into his office and sees on the office what he's going, the name Emil Frey III. I thought they'd misspelled his name and got it all wrong. It was really Emil Freyreich, no period, Emil J. Freyreich. Yeah. So yeah, that was a very interesting story. Zubrod was the master architect of this very small, relatively small team of people. And they weren't only working on leukemia. There were others who were working on other things as well. The real characters were Frey and Freyreich, with Freyreich being really two standard deviations beyond the mean.
Yeah, but getting back still to Zubrod, here's a guy who went to Columbia, who practiced, well, before anything, he was at, as a young doctor, he was working on the malaria program.
Yes.
And did you talk about that? Because I mean, he's fascinated by ethics of research, and he had done stuff that predates any ethical construct and probably couldn't have been done again and shouldn't have been done again.
I don't recall discussing malaria with Zubrod. I know he discussed his work on pneumococcal pneumonia at Hopkins.
Yeah.
And some of the research trials that he set up there, and that he used that framework for doing some of the studies at NCI with, you know, double blind studies and insisting on careful controls. And he imbued Frey and Freyreich, although Freyreich didn't always get it, in quite the way in which Zubrod meant it. They were a very interesting trio, those people. And Jim Holland had preceded Frey and really started the leukemia program at the NCI, but he left after a year or so, going back to Columbia.
But can we get back to Zubrod? Because when I think about that guy and his place in history, if he were not where he was, we would not be right now where we are, I think. Because here's a guy who understood how to do clinical research. He understood methodology of research. He understood how trials should be structured. He understood ethics of the thing, because he had done things both ways, ethically and unethically, or what would be considered ethical right now. What was it like to work with him? Because, you know, it's like when you had those patients you were taking care of, those kids who are dying, you had to get parents to say, yeah, try it.
Yes.
What was that like? How did he see all of this? What was him?
It was very difficult, because you can't be involved in the care of a three-year-old child who's bleeding from all orifices without being emotionally involved yourself. Doctors tell themselves that they can leave all this stuff behind them when they go home at night. I never could do that. I always took those problems home with me, which wasn't necessarily healthy. But I got support from Tom Frey. I rarely had to go to Gordon Zubrod, unless there was a problem with Frey or Freyreich. Freyreich was the bigger problem, because he wasn't quite as imbued with some of the, maybe not fair to say this, because it's a different time, but he wasn't quite as imbued with the ethics of what you can, what you should and shouldn't do to patients. You know, he took the point of view, if they're going to die, we got to do something now. We can't just sit around and pretend that everything's going to be all right. So he was all gung-ho to try drugs that hadn't, I mean, it was like my father not wanting to treat Babe Ruth without having studied the drug in normal subjects, find out what the dosages should be. So I think at the time that I was on the leukemia service, Fry Reich was more of my boss than Fry. And I would go back to Fry when I had problems with Fry Reich, and eventually I felt I could go to Subrod, but he didn't want to overrule his young guys, Fry and Fry Reich, unless there was a real moral dilemma, which
sure, it happened a lot with Fry.
We tried to keep that to a minimum, I would say. Try to solve the problems ourselves before they got to that stage. And oftentimes Fry Reich would give ground on it. He paid good attention to Fry, to Tom Fry, who's a much more level-headed thinker about patient problems of this kind. Fry Reich was a doer. When he saw the pathway, he wanted to go through that door, whether it was wide open or not. He wanted to go through that door.
How would Fry sort of temper that in Fry Reich? How would they interact?
They would interact every day. They would sit down and talk for hours at the end of the day and sort of plan what's the next step. Get a feel for how the patients were doing. So there was a lot of give and take between those two people. And then we participated. I was one of a number of young doctors like myself, who, in fact, quite a number of my Harvard medical classmates ended up at the National Cancer Institute at about the same time. David Nathan was with me. David Nathan eventually became head of the Farber Center. He was one. Tom Waldman, whom you may not have known, was still at NCI until a few years ago when he died, doing brilliant basic science work there. And so, and there were a few others. So there was a lot of good young people to interact with Fry Reich and Fry. And they were young themselves. They were only a year or so more advanced than we were in terms of clinical training. So everybody was pretty new at this stuff. And compared to Damashek or some of the other greats in American hematology who had years of experience taking care of patients with leukemia, we were beginners. And they were a bit contemptuous of us because they had never seen anybody do well taking care of patients with leukemia. And they were some of our harshest critics, I would say. They didn't think much of folks who were inclined to spend time taking care of patients with leukemia. Of the man who was head of hematology oncology at the Army, the Army Institute in Washington, he was very opposed to what we were doing.
What was Fry Reich? Did he ever tell you about his kind of personal history, where he's from, all of this, all of the things that are actually largely in this book? Did he tell you those stories in real time or much later?
It wasn't until I decided to look back on this period and write about it that I really sat down with him to talk about his personal development in medicine. And a strange journey it was for him, having come from nothing, really absolutely nothing, no father, a mother who couldn't speak the language, didn't know anything about education. They were virtually penniless. He was responsible for figuring out how to educate himself. He had a difficult time getting along with people all along the journey, along his journey. So I learned these things only afterwards, sitting down, and they were my friends. I mean, Fry Reich and Fry and Zubrod, I considered my friends. So it was afterwards that I sat down with them to talk about their, how they got into the field and what motivated them and so forth, which is what I think makes the book so interesting, is these were not people who were born with a silver spoon in their mouths, you know, who were destined to become great scientists from the moment they were born. They took various circuitous paths to get to achieve what they did achieve, and more power to them for being able to break down the barriers that they needed to break down in order to succeed.
Did you even know that Fry Reich was Jewish, or did that never even come up?
It never even came up.
So you had no idea?
No.
That's really fascinating, until you sat down with him in the tape recorder.
Right. I didn't know the personal lives, and I was very interested in Fry Reich's journey. I mean, when he writes, "I learned to be a mean person when I was an intern at Cook County Hospital." Oh, yeah. And he describes how the nurses had a special place in the back of the ward where they put patients who they thought weren't going to make it. And they didn't even take the doctors to make rounds on them. They just let them die. I didn't know that story at all until afterwards. Or Tom Fry's interesting story about his family being in the glass-making business.
Yeah, church glass. They're still in business.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think the company still exists.
Well, it was an interesting background. And Zubrod being assigned to, in the public health, being assigned to a general hospital with 1,000 patients. And he was like the only doctor.
Right. It's amazing.
And he ended up learning something along the way from every experience that he had. And so did these other people as well. Some of the basic scientists and their background, Howard Skipper in Birmingham, Alabama, how he supported himself as a football player. He's a very modest guy. He said, "I get hit in the head too many times to remember certain things." Anyway, these and Gertrude Elion coming up very poor, without much encouragement to go into chemistry. She ended up working for a bakery for a period of time to support herself. And then being picked up by Hitchings. I worked very, very closely with Hitchings and Elion when I was at Duke and they were at Burroughs Wellcome. Mm-hmm. We encouraged them to move from the New York area. They actually brought Burroughs Wellcome down to the Research Triangle Park. They were being crowded in New York and they needed to move somewhere. And Dr. Rundles, who was my boss at Duke, and I worked on itchings, showing them the advantages of moving into the Research Triangle area and having, you know, any amount of space that they needed, which was a great, it was a great opportunity, and they made the most of it.
That's amazing.
It was a great opportunity for us to work with them too.
How did you decide to write this book? Because it's the classic of this field. It's reading.
Well, I don't know. I got to a certain point. I had more time away from patients and was able to look back, and I had the opportunity to start the book by interviewing some. I took occasions of meeting Joe Birchenall and various others, Howard Skipper and others in my travels when I joined the Cancer Society, and I had the opportunity to become a temporary research fellow of the Rockefeller Association. So I had, my wife and I had something like six or 8 weeks at their place. When it first came out, I would get calls from parents who had children with leukemia. And, you know, they would write and tell me that this was very helpful to them.
Well, this is a really great book. It was helpful to anybody who is interested in the history of cancer. It's the book.
It's a great subject. I wrote it partly, I think you can see where I was coming from. I wrote it in the hope that young people would see that this was a career that they could do, because the background of the scientists was so ordinary. It wasn't that their parents had been great scientists and therefore they were destined to become great scientists themselves. No, they came from different aspects of the world, and they were driven by their own ambitions and talent. And so I think anybody could do it if they had those features, about they had the ambition and the talent. That's, I was hoping that inspire young people, and sorry that it didn't sell more widely than it did, but they did their best with it, I think.
Thank you for listening to the Cancer History Project podcast of oral histories and interviews with the people who have shaped oncology as we know it. Our archives are available online for free at cancerhistoryproject.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @cancerhistproj. The Cancer History Project is a collaborative historical resource operated by the Cancer Letter. This is an ongoing project and would not be possible without the input and materials provided by our editorial board, our contributors, and the support of our sponsors, including Cedars-Sinai, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center, and many others. View a full list of our sponsors at cancerhistoryproject.com/sponsors. If your institution would like to participate in the Cancer History Project, email us at admin@cancerhistoryproject.com.